You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora. This week on Dear Science, we are joined by our expert professor, Alan Blackman, from the Auckland University of Technology to talk about some current affairs in the world of science. How are you today?
I'm wet and cold and it's miserable out there, but yeah. I guess this is our first go together, so we'll see how all this runs. I see the wording is the same since Caster.
I thought it would be good to keep that together, keep it quite consistent for you.
That's this expert thing that gets me. Anyway.
Every time. What's your first topic for us today?
So today we're going, as you said, astronomical, and we're going into the heavens, the stars, and one particular star, and that is a star called Betelgeuse.
Now don't say it three times.
Okay. Come on. And those of you who know The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which you probably all should No. Gosh, I'm getting some confused looks here.
I've heard of this and I haven't seen it.
I haven't heard of it.
Everybody's too young these days. That's where Ford Prefect and Zaphod Beeblebrox came from. But you should read that book. It's a very funny book. Anyway, Betelgeuse. So those of you who know your stars, you'll know that that's a member, as it were, of the constellation Orion. And you can always spot Orion because there's those three stars in a row.
Yeah, Orion's
that's his
belt.
That's his belt.
Right.
That's the one. And Betelgeuse is the big red star that you can see. So if you look very, very closely at Orion, you'll see one of the stars in the corner is distinctly red. And it's the 10th or the 9th, depending on who you believe, brightest star in the sky, which is pretty cool. And when I say big star, I mean like big star. Like, this is ridiculously big. So we think of our sun as being a big star compared to the Earth. I think it can fit something like a million Earths inside the sun, something like that. I'm pretty sure that's the number. Okay, so we take that, and Betelgeuse has a radius around about sort of 700 times that of the sun. So that would put it out almost near Jupiter.
Wow. Okay.
Which is just ridiculous. So this is a massive, massive, massive star. So that's about 600 million kilometers radius. So double that for a diameter. So, yeah, it's big. It's big. And weirdly, really, really weirdly, and this I didn't know until I looked it up, it's only 10 million years old. And that's pretty much nothing on sort of the universal timescale. The universe is about 13.7 billion years old. Our sun is about 5 billion years old. This is only 10 million years old.
That's quite surprising.
And they reckon that what is going to happen is it's going to go supernova sometime in the next 100,000 years. So it's going to basically explode, turn into a white dwarf, and then maybe a black hole, and blah, blah, blah. All of that good stuff that stars do. And we've actually talked about Betelgeuse previously on Dear Science a few years ago, because people were getting interested about this because it was giving a variable brightness. So its brightness was varying over time, and people think, ooh, hang on, this might mean it's going to go supernova very soon, so we could get this fantastic spectacle in the sky. But they eventually figured out that what had happened was that there was a big ejection of dust, and the dust had made it appear dimmer than it should have been, and they basically put it down to that. However, this dust thing might or might not be the correct description of what was going on, because a bunch of people at NASA and at Georgia Tech this week have published a paper saying that Betelgeuse has a beetle buddy, as they call it, which I think is quite cute.
And they've never seen this before.
That's
quite shocking.
Well, okay, so Betelgeuse is massive and it's very, very bright. Mm-hmm. So anything that's sort of pretty close to it is going to be difficult to observe. And indeed it is. But this was sort of predicted over about 100 or so years ago. People thought that, yeah, this could be what's happening here. It could have a twin, well, not so much a twin, but a very, very small nephew or whatever, that's orbiting Betelgeuse. Or, in fact, they're orbiting each other. But that could also explain the variable brightness thing as well.
So they're both stars. They can both orbit each other.
Yeah.
That's kind of random.
Yeah, yeah. So that's so what they think now, what they think they've seen, and they're pretty sure, they're not certain, but they reckon that they've seen the smaller star that is pretty much right next door to Betelgeuse. Now, when I say smaller, it's still about 1.5 times the size of our sun. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not negligible when it's compared to Betelgeuse. It's,
when you say right next door, you mean how far away is that actually?
Ah, geez. Now you've got me.
Relatively close, but probably quite far away. So.
Yes. No, I think in the grand scheme of things, it was about, I think they're saying about 14 times the distance of the Earth to the Sun, something like that. Mm-hmm. So still a decent distance, but relatively speaking, pretty close.
Right on.
Okay. And so what they did in order to see this, they need, you know, special technology and everything and very, very fancy stuff. So there's an 8.1 meter diameter telescope in Hawaii, and mm-hmm. 8.1 meters is just ridiculously big, which could resolve essentially this very, very faint object that's next door to an extraordinarily bright object. And they managed to do that. And as I say, they're pretty sure that this is what's happening. They're pretty sure. So statistically speaking, it's nearly absolutely statistically significant, but not quite. But they're pretty confident that this is what's going on. And they do have pictures of it if you care to look it up on the net. It's just this little blue sort of fuzz next door to this big red thing.
Yeah, right.
And what they think is going to happen, or what they basically know is going to happen, that it's so close to this massive star that it's eventually going to get sucked into it. Good old gravity and all of that. And they reckon, in the not-too-distant future anyway, maybe in the next 10,000 years, something like that. So,
oh, yeah, I don't think we'll stick around for that.
Maybe not. That's very cool.
But, you know, that's kind of cool. I mean, here is a star that, you know, humanity has been looking at since its evolution, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is something that we didn't know was there until today. And so, you know, using all of the amazing stuff that we've got now, who knows what else is out there that we haven't yet seen.
Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty to discover in that space.
Absolutely. Oh, I see what you did there. Space. Oh,
I didn't even see what good. I did there. So that's actually well put. I'll move on to, you've got your next topic here. It's a bit of a pivot. I wanted to talk about this step count article that you've shared with us. I've always heard it was 10,000. I've heard that was also kind of an arbitrary number, but this one says different. Do you want to talk about that?
Indeed. Well, you know, we all know, hopefully, that walking is good for you, but perhaps just not quite how good. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's some astonishing numbers in this that we'll get to, but the question is, okay, so how many steps should you take in a day for it to do you good? Okay. I mean, most of us, unfortunately, there are some who can't, but most of us of necessity have to walk here and there. Some of us do it more than others. And so the question, as I say, the scientific question out there, you've heard that number 10,000.
Yeah.
And yes, you heard correctly that it's sort of an arbitrary thing. So what is the optimal number of steps? So a bunch of workers in Spain asked this very same question. Mm-hmm. And there's been, in fact, a lot of work done on this question. Okay, so looking at basically the health benefits of walking.
Yeah.
And so what they came to the conclusion of, well, what they did first was they needed something to measure relative to, okay? So nobody walks zero steps in a day unless you're in a wheelchair or, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And so they took a baseline of 2,000 steps a day. And then they're sort of measuring everything else relative to that. So they've got people who, you know, walk 2,000 steps a day. How do they compare to people who walk 5,000 or 10,000 or 15,000 steps a day? What are the health benefits relative to that sort of baseline? And so what they did was to look at all of these studies, and their conclusion was that 7,000 is the number. So 7,000 steps seems to be optimal compared to the 2,000 steps thing. And basically, if you go beyond that, then any added benefits are essentially minimal. Okay. So if you did 10,000 rather than your 7,000, yeah, it's going to be a little bit better for you, but it's not as absolutely massive as the difference between your 2,000 and your 7,000. And by absolutely massive, here are some numbers. I mean, this is just amazing. So compared to those who walk 2,000 steps, so the ones who walk 7,000 steps, a 47% drop in the risk of death from any cause within several years of that. 47%, whoa. You know. That's
just
up there.
From 7,000 to 10,000?
No, just those 7,000 steps.
Yeah, right.
So compared with the ones who do 2,000.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's 47% drop. That's almost as massive as Trump, you know. You know, it's just extraordinary in percentage terms. What else? A 25% lower risk of cardiovascular disease, 37% lower risk of dying from cancer, 38% lower risk of dementia. Look, hell, I'm getting out there and I'm starting walking. Honestly, mm-hmm. You know, those are extraordinary numbers. So set up the old watch and away we go on this, I think. And as I said, you know, yes, you can get more benefit by walking a larger number of steps, but just the added benefits just sort of drop off.
Yeah, they're still going up, I imagine, but they're just going up slower.
But it's plateauing, essentially.
Yeah, I see.
So by the time you get to 7,000, you're almost at the top of the plateau in terms of your benefits. And going that much further isn't going to sort of help you all that much more. So I think that's a remarkable discovery. And really and honestly, you know, a man of my age, you know, I've got to start thinking about such things. So I'm going to get out there and, get onto it.
Well, it might be a bit challenging in the weather today, but I'm sure you can pull out 7,000. Yeah.
Well, I've got to walk back to AUT, so, you know.
Walk around the hill.
Downhill does that. If it's, let's say, whether it's uphill or you're just walking at a brisk pace, does that increase the benefits, or is it just the number of steps?
No, I think this was purely just on the basis of a number of steps. Yeah.
Oh.
And you would think that obviously walking up, you know, should probably be better for you. Yeah. You would have thought.
Yeah,
but,
it's like, you know, going on the Stairmaster at the gym. Like, something like that. Was that? That's a bit useless.
Killer. Oh my god.
Yeah, just do it flat. Yeah.
My final, your final topic, sorry, is this: the passing of Tom Lehrer. He was a mathematician and did some things in the science space. Did you want to talk about what he meant for you, or what he meant generally?
No, well, I saw this on Sunday, and I thought, oh, that's really sad. And so
he was quite old. How old was he? He was
97.
97. That is quite impressive. He's done a lot of things in his life, I'm sure.
And so I mentioned this to my class yesterday, and all I got was blank looks. And, I know. That's what happens when you get old, folks. But Tom Lehrer, okay, so yes, he was a Harvard mathematician. That was his job. He was a mathematician at Harvard. And he sort of took up writing sort of satirical songs, I think, during his undergraduate years or whatever. But then they just became very, very popular, and he was very, very clever. He was a real wordsmith. One of his great rhymes comes from a song called Lobachevsky, and it's plagiarize, let no one else's work evade your eyes. Which, that's good.
Tell that to your students.
And, you know, songs with a title like The Masochism Tango and Poisoning Pigeons in the Park. He was very, very sort of, it's very clever, very sort of anti-establishment, but he did things in sort of language that people wouldn't really realize that it was satire until it was sort of too late. And, you know, and I'm mentioning this because he was a mathematician and everything, but he did write songs about science. And his most famous song, which we are just going to do
we've
now,
got it ready. Yeah,
it's the all t- it's song. All queued up. This is The Chemical Elements by Tom Lehrer.
Oh, ooh, let me think. Do I know that?
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium, and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonium, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
And that was Tom Lehrer, the wonderful Tom Lehrer.
I don't know if any of you have heard that song. That's a pretty good one.
I think if we've got any more elderly listeners, let's say, they would probably be familiar with that. Surely. And just as a little aside, he actually toured New Zealand in 1960 and played 10 dates.
Did he play those songs?
Yeah, song? Yes.
Wow. Were there some science nerds who would think, wow, I can't wait to hear the Element song live. Oh, my God. People think that.
But I think that's extremely clever. And, RIP Tom Lehrer. Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing all those topics with us today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you, Alan, thank you, Motat, and thank you, Science. That is the end of the Dear Science segment, I suppose.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.